Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight. You can find the list of participating Portland area restaurants at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The Western Regional Advocacy Project is celebrating 10 years of fighting for affordable housing and against the criminalization of people who are homeless. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the RAP 10-year anniversary concert featuring Mike Crenshaw, Saturday, October 17th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center. RAP is a national leader in both street outreach and grassroots organizing against homelessness. KBOO will be live streaming the concert from our website. Again, that's the RAP 10-year anniversary concert, Saturday, October 17th, 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, located at 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under KBOO Community Events.
Rhythm is hitting, we want to make it clear. We ain't scared, this is the vision we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program, The Forbidden Bookshelf and Banned Books Week. Censorship comes in many guises, and free expression is still under attack in the so-called land of the free. We'll speak with New York University media scholar Mark Crispin Miller about his latest project about disappeared books on controversial topics. It's called The Forbidden Bookshelf. Peter Hart, the communications director for National Coalition Against Censorship, also joins the program. He'll talk about Banned Books Week, which was celebrated recently in the United States. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we look at various issues of censorship, and our first guest is Professor Mark Crispin Miller. He is a professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University and the author of several books, including Boxed In, The Culture of TV, The Bush Dyslexicon, Observations on a National Disorder, Cruel and Unusual, Bush Cheney's New World Order, and Fooled Again, The Real Case for Electoral Reform. Most recently, Mark Crispin Miller has also been working on a series for Open Road Media called Forbidden Bookshelf. And the introduction to Forbidden Bookshelf at openroadmedia.com explains this project by stating, for more than half a century, America's vast literary culture has been disparately policed and imperceptibly contained by state and corporate entities well-placed and perfectly equipped to wipe out wayward writings. As America does not ban books, other means, less obvious and so less controversial, have been deployed to vaporize them. The purpose of Forbidden Bookshelf is to bring such disappeared books back to life so that readers may finally learn what those in power did not want anyone to know. And joining us is Professor Mark Crispin Miller to give us an update about Forbidden Bookshelf and talk about broadening definitions of censorship. Mark, you join us by phone.
Nice to be with you guys again. The purpose of this series is to revive titles that have been snuffed out far less obviously and therefore far less controversially than those books that are now and then suppressed in various far-flung school districts, you know, municipalities where people get their knickers in a twist over various erotic classics. So we've all heard about these controversial attempts to ban books like Toni Morrison's Beloved or 1984 or Lady Chatterley's Lover, or Heather Has Two Daddies or Two Mommies, books that offend various religious and sometimes patriotic sensibilities. My view is that that kind of sporadic and occasional suppression of really famous titles that are widely available and universally well-known is nowhere near as troubling or dangerous as the successful extinction of a surprisingly large number of books that they're not erotic classics, but they deal with serious abuses of power, high crimes by the government, corporations, books that really are kind of a threat to the status quo, certainly a threat to various really mighty interests, and that therefore have been pretty much extinguished, you know, killed at birth through various inexplicit means. The series includes a lot of those books, as well as some that did make something of a splash when they first came out, but that just slipped out of print very quickly and that people need to know about. So the purpose of this series is to bring them back with new introductions, unfortunately only as e-books, because the series would otherwise be economically infeasible. But our aim is to publish them again. Sometimes people say, well, you want this book, you can just go on Amazon and find a used copy. Well, first of all, that's not true of all the titles in the series, because some of them are hard to find even that way. But also, if you go looking on Amazon for a particular title, that presupposes you're knowing it exists. The fact is that these are books that most people don't know exist. And there's a difference between some used copies being out there for people to buy and books being published. Publishing is the key thing here, because when you publish a book, you make the world aware of it. Or at least you do if you have friends like you guys who will have me on the radio to talk about the series. Yeah. You know, it's still a challenge. I mean, it was a challenge for these books when they first came out to break through the firewall of the corporate press. And it's still a challenge. So I think it's an exciting project and an important one, so we're eager to spread the word about it.
Mark, you use the word extinction, like The Hidden History of the Korean War. Okay,
right.
That's a book I.F. Stone been about out there for a while. How does that become extinct, or what do you mean by that, and how deliberate is that?
Well, you know, in the case of that book, for example, as I'm sure you know, Stone had a very difficult time getting it published at all in the United States. I mean, I think the number of publishers who rejected it was maybe as high as 30. It finally came out from Monthly Review Press, you know, this independent Marxist publishing house, and had a kind of underground reputation. Then was, you know, republished years later, still by a small concern. I want to add parenthetically that the publication of that book kind of destroyed Stone's career for a good 20 years. I mean, he was really outcast because he dared to question the official narrative of how the Korean War started, and he did it while the war was still going on. It is a smashing piece of research, a really powerful book, and contains revelations about that war that people to this day don't know. Again, the book does exist out there, people know about it, but most people are unaware that it exists. They're either unaware of it, you know, across the board, they don't know about it at all, or they're unaware that it's available again. So we brought it back with a new introduction by Professor Bruce Cummings of the University of Chicago, a beautiful introduction. So to answer your question, by extinct, I mean in a state where most people don't know it's there. Even many academics are unaware that these books exist. I can attest to that as a professor myself. And the question, how deliberate is it? I have to say, I think in most of these cases, it's quite deliberate. Let me give you a couple of examples. Another of the books we've brought back is DuPont Dynasty, Behind the Nylon Curtain by Gerard Colby. This is an absolutely authoritative history of the DuPont family and the DuPont Corporation from the time they got to this country in like 1802 up to the present. And it is not just a story of that extraordinarily powerful dynasty, but also a story of America itself, of industrialization, of the financialization of the economy. Anyone who really wants to know what's been going on in this country has got to read this book. Well, when it came out in 1974, the DuPonts actually colluded with Prentice Hall, the first publisher, to sink the book, which they did by arranging to have too few copies printed up, fewer than were contracted, so few that there was no way for them, for the publisher, to make a profit on it, so they didn't promote it, books were not shipped, and it kind of disappeared, known only to people who follow this kind of scandal. 10 years later, Lyle Stewart, kind of maverick publisher in New York, brought it out again, and a revised and expanded edition. You're going to love this. It had in it 30 pages concerning what had happened to the first edition. Well, somehow, coincidentally, And amazingly, one-third of the print run was damaged, and it was damaged specifically in that those 30 pages were missing from the books. So once again, we could say through happenstance, the print run was damaged in a way that made the book a kind of financial non-starter, and it disappeared again. So we brought it back. Books like Douglas Valentine's The Phoenix Program, an essential history of the CIA's most notorious, one of the most notorious covert operations, and an indispensable book about the Vietnam War. This was a covert program of torture, kidnapping, and assassination of civilians in South Vietnam that the CIA ran for some 7 years during that war. The CIA tried to prevent Valentine from finishing the book by interfering with the research. He sued over this. And when it came out, it was done in by a malicious review by CBS newsman Morley Safer in the New York Times Book Review, which basically accused Valentine of sloppy reporting, making things up. And on the strength of that review, the publisher canceled the paperback deal for the book. A similar thing happened with Christopher Simpson's book Blowback, which is the first and still the best book about U.S. recruitment of former fascists and Nazis during the Cold War. This is a book that is not mentioned or listed in the bibliographies of two recent books on the same subject that were published to a lot of enthusiastic reviews that came out within the last year or so. And it's as if Simpson's book never existed, because he goes further than these more recent books and talks about the incalculable damage done to American politics and society by this wholesale recruitment of ultra-rightist fanatics throughout the U.S. government. So the book has been kind of disappeared in that way. He could only get it published by a British publisher, Weidenfeld and Nicholson. It came out in this country, published by that house, and again, it was done in by a malicious review in the New York Times. I'll just add this very quickly, by Sergei Shmaiman, a longtime reporter at the New York Times, whose own father was heavily involved with some of the Eastern European fascist emigres that Simpson's book deals with. Shmaiman's father was actually an avid defender of Valerian Trifa, who was a fascist Romanian cleric. That doesn't come up in the review. There is no mention of the fact that Shmaiman has a conflict of interest. So, you know, you look at enough of these examples of how these books were kind of done in, you would be extremely trusting, and I think a bit naive, to think that this kind of thing was not deliberate, that these books were targeted.
You can learn more at openroadmedia.com. That's where the e-books are all published. These are in e-book form. And Mark Crispin Miller, among the most recent here, we spoke with Peter Dale Scott recently about Dallas 63. That's one of the more recent e-publications from the series, is it not?
Yes, it is. It's part of the latest tranche of titles, and we're delighted that Peter let us do it. And as I think he told you, this version of Dallas 63 is considerably revised and expanded beyond its previous versions. So it's quite exciting, especially since books on subjects like the Kennedy assassination are of particular interest to us in this series. But we've also done a book in the same tranche of titles called Inside Job by Stephen Piso and others, which is about the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s. And we have coming out in the next few months The Wages of War by Richard Severo, which is the only history of how the veterans of all of America's wars, from the Revolutionary War up through the Vietnam War, have been, with the exception of World War II, have been monumentally screwed over after those conflicts have ended. This is a really indispensable history of that particular phenomenon, and it's therefore one that people really need to know about, because, you know, the fate of our war's veterans is not improved any since that book came out. There are many others, but let me conclude by saying that we're really intent on bringing these books back, first of all, because they're all excellent books, and their authors, both living and deceased, certainly deserve a second chance. But more importantly, we want to bring these books back because the American people deserve and need to read them. It's because of books like these, not books like Lady Chatterley's Lover and Howl and Beloved, books that I personally love. This is not to disrespect them, but the purpose of the First Amendment was not to protect edgy literary works. I mean, you know, erotic classics is a concept unknown to the likes of John Adams. The purpose of the First Amendment, rather, was to protect the authors and reporters of information that could threaten the power of the government. They wanted to protect the press and expression generally from government interference, from that kind of tyranny. And the books that we're bringing back are precisely the kinds of books that I think the, you know, drafters of the First Amendment would have understood the American people need to read, because if you don't know about this sort of dark side of American history, you're at risk. You know, your rights are at risk. Your freedoms are at risk. Your wealth, your property, your welfare, all these things are at risk. So, you know, we see this project as somehow profoundly patriotic in the best sense.
Forbidden Bookshelf is the series, openroadmedia.com. You can learn more. Mark Crispin Miller, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
Anytime, guys. Thanks a million.
We've just been speaking with New York University professor Mark Crispin Miller about his series Forbidden Bookshelf, and now we're going to talk about Banned Books Week, which was celebrated recently in the United States. And to do that, we're joined by Peter Hart. Peter Hart is the National Coalition Against Censorship's communications director. For 15 years, he worked at the national media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org, where he wrote numerous articles and co-hosted the nationally syndicated radio program Counterspin. Peter Hart joins us today by phone. Peter, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So, Peter Hart, tell us about your work with National Coalition Against Censorship, of which Project Censored is a proud member. We're proud to belong to NCAC and support all the great work that NCAC does. But tell us more specifically, you finished not long ago this campaign called Banned Books Week that's been going on for decades. Tell us a little bit about what was going on for Banned Books Week and NCAC's role.
I think people are familiar with Banned Books Week if they walk into a public library or to a decent independent bookstore that week. And the idea is to celebrate the freedom to read, to celebrate the victories over government or private suppression of speech, the banning of books from school libraries, from high school or middle school curricula, and so forth. And I think to raise awareness of the fact that these battles continue to go on, whether it is a parent who objects to a world history class that discusses Islam, or a parent who wants LGBT books out of the children's section of the library because they promote perversion. These are still very much live issues, and Banned Books Week tries to, I think, thread that needle to say, we've had a history of censorship, and we've overcome and won many of those battles, but there are still battles that are being fought every single day in schools and in libraries across the country. The hope is that in the long run, people begin to understand that children or young adults don't need to be shielded from the realities of life. They need to learn how to grapple with these important questions. Whether they be questions in literature or art or world history, they're important lessons that young people can learn from reading material that challenges them, that challenges their parents' way of thinking. I think most of us, and certainly most of the people listening to this radio show, had a moment in their lives where they were exposed to information that contradicted what they had understood about the world up to that point and changed them as human beings. I know it's true for me, and it's true for most of the people I know who got involved in freedom to read or free speech or political organizing. And the idea that young people are prevented from following that path is really ultimately destructive and harmful. So the idea is to promote the idea that young people can have the freedom to inquire and to search and to read as much as they can in order to forge their own path.
We read about how Ruth Graham at Slate wrote that there is basically no such thing as banned books, and wanted to get your take on that. And it seems that I think it's implied that the government's not banning books overall, but these are incidental happenings. So how did you respond to her?
Yeah, it's a deep question, you know, and it's something I'm sure I don't need to tell anyone around Project Censored, that people's ideas of what censorship is and is not can be very complicated and confusing, and they sort of need to be unpacked. Her piece was called, you know, This is the Internet, so we pick subtle headlines, Banned Books Week is a crock. And the argument, let me tell you what she got right, I guess, because it's important to understand this. She was trying to argue that there's a difference between a parent or a community member challenging a book in a curriculum and a book being banned. And that's important. There is a difference between challenging something and a school board or a school district saying this should be removed from the classroom. They're not the same thing at all. And some challenges are good if we can use a value judgment when parents and teachers or anyone else decides they want to question what's being taught in school. That often can be a very beneficial process. You know, this week we saw a student who noticed that his world history textbook in high school referred to slaves as workers in a picture caption. So he took a photograph of it, sent it to his mother. His mother recorded a Facebook video. It's been viewed 2 million times. And the publishing giant that is responsible for this book is rewriting it. They're going to send out stickers to cover this up. And it fueled this whole discussion about how do we teach children about slavery? How do we teach U.S. history? How do we teach world history? That's important, and that's it's a good thing for anyone to speak up against powerful institutions, and these challenges happen. I guess the distinction to be made is what kinds of challenges and on what grounds, and we're talking about the numbers that are compiled by the ALA, and they say we're aware of about 300 such challenges a year, usually about inappropriate content in books at the middle school and high school level, language, sexual content, that sort of thing. And we have to understand that that's the 300 that we know about that are reported publicly or reported directly to the ALA. It's a vast undercount of the whole problem. So we know that that number just gives us a slice of what's going on. We know that schools and librarians are fearful about speaking up about this. We know that these kinds of challenges can lead to what we like to refer to as a chilling effect. If a librarian goes through a problem where, you know, 10 very noisy parents want this gay and lesbian book taken out of the library, how does that affect the librarian's choice of books going forward? Has this person learned a particular lesson? Very difficult to get at that kind of stuff. And that's where the effects of censorship can be hard to track and hard to parse. You know, the School Library Journal tried to do a study of this a couple of years ago, surveying librarians. And they did find, you know, I think something like 70% of librarians said that a challenge affected their future book buying. That suggests that the process can be very stressful, that librarians might be worried about their jobs, and they learn lessons to avoid certain kinds of content. You know, when we talk about this in the realm of journalism, for example, we say journalists learn the rules of the road if they're working in sort of high-profile corporate media, that there are risks to offending certain sponsors or to your owners and so forth. This isn't written down somewhere. Journalists don't like to talk about it, and the same is true, I think, for educators and librarians. It's a dirty little secret, as the School Library Journal put it. So we have, I think, real serious evidence that there is a chilling effect, that it affects how librarians or administrators or English teachers go forward. I mean, imagine you're teaching 11th grade AP English and you start receiving complaints that what you're teaching in your class is inappropriate. Now, let's hope that you have the job security and the strength to say, no, here's why we teach that and here's why it's important. But many teachers might feel otherwise, and other teachers might observe the lesson of your of what you go through and say, you know what, I'm going to avoid that. The other problem, and this comes up a lot in her piece and elsewhere, is that, well, if a book is removed, it's removed because parents wanted to have a say in their child's education, and it's silly to say that that should be forbidden or something. And that's a straw man. You know, no one is saying that parents shouldn't be involved in their kids' schools or their kids' education. The distinction is, should one parent be able to control the curriculum for an entire classroom or an entire grade level because he or she has religious views or moral views that they find are undermined by what is taught in the classroom? That's the distinction. And when you allow one person's complaint to drive curricular choices, you're no longer putting teachers and educators and administrators in control of that. You're trying to appease a small group of individuals who have a problem with this or that. That is the kind of situation that we have to avoid if we're to have strong and independent public schools. The other argument that is made in her piece and is made elsewhere that, well, you know, we have Amazon, we have public libraries. A book is no longer banned. You just have to go buy it somewhere else or check it out of the library. Stop with all the fear-mongering and the nonsense. And the appropriate reaction to that, I think, is that, A, those avenues aren't available for all students, and, B, there is an important aspect of teaching students about a given work, to having classroom discussions, to exploring this with a professional educator who's thought about how to teach difficult subjects. The difference between reading a people's history on your own and reading it in class with your classmates, the latter is, I think, a far more enriching and nourishing experience, and one that I would wish on any high school student in the country. So to say, well, because some parents don't like that book, you can read it on your own. Yeah, that's great. I understand that. But a more powerful and, I think, a more transformative experience is when students who aren't seeking out that kind of information are forced to grapple with it and to understand and to, I think, expand their minds. That's what school is for, and that, I think, is the kind of the missing piece in these arguments about whether books are really, quote-unquote, banned. In the end, we want schools to expose students to a wide variety of topics and a wide variety of issues, and the way to do that is in the classroom.
What else is National Coalition Against Censorship working on right now? What are some of the other frontline battles and other ways you're promoting education about censorship at National Coalition Against Censorship? Peter Hart?
Well, we're working on this report about a survey of professors regarding trigger warnings, and our hope is that it's going to expand the discussion of this topic so that people begin to understand that in the real world where professors are teaching and questioning these ideas and dealing with students' concerns, the requests to avoid certain content or to be warned of certain content is a lot broader than we think. I think it has more profound academic freedom implications than we think. So the hope is that it kind of enlarges that conversation so that people begin to understand that it's not just about feminist students who don't want to read this or that. And if we can do that, that would be, I think, of enormous benefit to anyone who cares about free speech and free expression. We're working on a project about student free expressions, particularly on social media. The private companies that monitor Twitter and Facebook feeds on behalf of schools and school districts to flag quote-unquote inappropriate content. This is, I think, an issue that flies under the radar because students often who are sanctioned or who are punished do not want to speak out for fear of doing further damage to their academic futures or to their job prospects. But there are real concerns about surveillance and about the ability of students to speak to one another in this relatively unmoderated space, that is Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and the like. So I think there are these new avenues where the free speech battles are being fought, and they're often outside of government control. They're private companies that have their own rules of the road. So we have to start asking kind of big picture questions about what is the responsibility of a private company like Twitter or Facebook to core free speech principles? As private corporations, they really don't have any. They make appeals and, you know, they can generate rhetoric in this regard. But what are their rules and what are the limits and how can we push them to change the practices that are in place to encourage a more robust national conversation about issues that people want to keep under wraps? Those are the big questions, and those are the things I think we're trying to tackle in addition to the challenges to books in libraries and schools, which I think are the kind of bread and butter free speech issues we've been working on for going on over four decades now.
So listeners can go to ALA.org, NCAC.org, and BannedBooksWeek.org to learn more about some of the things that we've been discussing today. Peter Hart, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Peter Hart from National Coalition Against Censorship. Before that, Mark Crispin Miller about Forbidden Bookshelf. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 25 stations around the United States. Archives can be found at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
And you're tuned to Community Radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM, Hood River, and 104.3 FM, Philomath and the Willamette Valley.